This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
Today, we are tackling a story that is, well, it's etched in stone. The joint discovery of evolution by natural selection.
It's the standard narrative, isn't it?
Yeah.
We all learn the names Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, two giants who independently arrived at the same monumental theory.
And then, through a stroke of historical timing, presented their ideas side by side in London in 1858.
It's the perfect tale of scientific synchronization.
It is perfect, maybe a little too perfect. We've been immersed in sources, historical accounts, detailed theoretical critiques, and modern scientific analysis, and they suggest that this standard narrative, well, specifically the claim that Wallace was a true co-discoverer of the full theory, is potentially an historical myth.
Mm-hmm.
The differences between their theories were profound, and they have massive implications for how we view evolution today.
Exactly. Our source material forces us to look beyond the shared priority and ask a very difficult question. Did Wallace's 1858 essay actually present a complete nomological theory of evolution?
And many specialized historians and biologists now argue, what?
They argue that a careful reading reveals crucial gaps and that Darwin alone must be credited with providing the complete causal mechanism that led to the paradigm shift of 1859.
So our mission today is a deep dive into the high drama of that infamous 1858 presentation at the Linnean Society, the panic, the maneuvering, and the accusations of deceit.
And more importantly, we're going to dissect the theoretical divides buried within those joint papers.
Exploring how those differences manifest in everything from 19th century philosophical debates to, and this is fascinating, modern evolutionary psychology's obsession with beauty and mate choice. You're going to see this foundational story in a completely new light.
I think so.
So let's begin our journey. Let's go back 160 years ago to the Malay Archipelago, specifically Ternate, in February 1858. We have Alfred Russel Wallace, the intrepid naturalist, far from home, and he is grappling with a severe illness.
Yeah, likely tropical fevers, possibly malaria. And this is the moment. This is when the mechanism of evolution suddenly materialized in his mind.
The setting here is just so crucial. Wallace was deeply invested in fieldwork, and his scientific curiosity went way beyond just collecting specimens. He had the strong interest in the ethnology and geography of the archipelago,
which led him toward population dynamics. Lying there sick, he recalled reading Thomas Malthus's essay on the principle of population years and years earlier.
Ah, Malthus. The core argument being, of course, that populations grow geometrically while resources grow arithmetically.
Which inevitably leads to a struggle for existence. And Wallace, remembering Malthus, first applies this devastating logic to human populations. He realized the implications of resource scarcity, of competitive pressure. And from there, it was like a flash. He instantaneously extended the principle to the animal world.
He saw that this constant struggle would favor certain varieties, leading to the preservation of some and the death of others.
The mechanism of descent with modification driven by environmental pressure, it just became suddenly clear to him.
But it's really important to stress that Wallace wasn't starting from scratch on the idea of evolution itself. He already accepted that species changed over time.
Precisely. His 1855 paper on the law, which has regulated the introduction of new species, it already demonstrated the reality of evolutionary change. He showed that new species always appear near related older species, which hints strongly at common ancestry.
So the Ternate essay wasn't a revelation that evolution happened.
No, not at all. It was a revelation of the mechanism, the how and the why it occurred. So once he recovered, he quickly wrote his manuscript, On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from the Original Type, and addressed it to his contact, Charles Darwin.
Okay, now let's pivot to Darwin back in England. He had been quietly working on this concept for two decades, keeping meticulous notes since the 1830s.
He was writing this monumental, exhaustive manuscript, what he called his big book, which he titled Natural Selection.
Can you imagine Darwin's state of mind? He's deep into his work, preparing a text that was slated to be maybe 2,000 pages long, just packed with every known example and defense.
And then in June 1858, Wallace's small manuscript arrives. The shock was paralyzing.
We have Darwin's immediate reaction in his famous letter to Charles Lyell, the geologist, and his close confidant, and Darwin was just devastated. He wrote, I never saw a more striking coincidence. If Wallace had my MS sketch written out in 1843, he could not have made a better short abstract.
And this initial comparison, this is the genesis of the myth, really, because Darwin immediately leaped to the conclusion that Wallace had presented the exact same detailed, two-decade matured theory he had.
He didn't initially dissect the subtle but crucial theoretical differences we're about to discuss.
No, he just saw his life's work forestalled.
So overwhelmed, Darwin immediately shares the letter and the manuscript with Lyell and Joseph Dalton Hooker, the prominent botanist. And in doing so, he effectively introduces them to Wallace's work with this massive bias that it was merely a compressed version of his own.
Which placed Lyell and Hooker in an incredibly difficult position regarding scientific priority.
A very tricky spot.
They chose to intervene decisively. They opted for the joint presentation at the Linnean Society on July 1st, 1858. And they rationalized this decision by stating they were considering not just the claims to priority, but the interests of science generally.
That phrase, the interests of science generally, tells you everything, doesn't it? They were positioning the discussion.
Absolutely. They argued it was desirable that views founded on a wide deduction from facts and matured by years of reflection. A clear reference to Darwin's two decades of unpublished work should constitute the starting point for scientific discussion, alongside Wallace's timely contribution.
So the joint presentation was a calculated move to secure Darwin's primacy, and it wasn't just Wallace's essay that was read.
No, not at all. To cement Darwin's long-standing claim, the presentation was split into three parts. First, extracts from Darwin's own unpublished 1844 manuscript sketch.
Okay.
Second, an abstract of a private letter Darwin had sent to the American botanist Asa Gray in September 1857, which demonstrated his views had been consistent since the late 1830s.
And then finally.
And third, Wallace's Turnet essay, dead last.
This was a legalistic approach to scientific history, really, designed to preempt any argument that Darwin was just reacting to Wallace. But despite all this careful staging, the immediate public reception was famously silent.
It was profoundly anticlimactic. Our sources confirm that the papers generated virtually no public attention. Darwin himself noted that the only published notice he could recall was from a professor, Samuel Houghton of Dublin,
who delivered one of the most scathing historical verdicts you could imagine.
It was brutal. Houghton's verdict was, all that was new in them was false, and what was true was old.
That's just devastating. Essentially, he was saying the true parts, you know, that evolution happens, were already known, and the new part, natural selection as the mechanism, was just wrong.
It's hard to imagine a more muted launch for a world-changing idea.
The subdued initial reception only makes the subsequent theoretical analysis more critical. So we need to transition now to the core of the intellectual debate, the argument that the 1858 narrative is a myth because Wallace did not, in fact, present a complete theory of evolution by natural selection.
Okay, yes. Let's get into it.
Let's unpack that loaded term first, a complete nomological theory. What does that even entail, and why is it the standard we must apply to both men's work?
Okay, so when we talk about a complete causal theory, particularly a nomological one, we are discussing a law-like, comprehensive explanation. It needs to identify a necessary and sufficient set of causes for a phenomenon to occur consistently.
And the phenomenon here is what exactly?
It's phyletic evolution or anagenesis. That's the linear change and transformation within the lineage over time.
So it's not enough to just say things change. You have to establish the rules, the laws by which that change happens.
Precisely. If you miss a necessary component, the theory, while it might offer brilliant insight, is fundamentally incomplete as a nomological explanation. The biologist Ernst Mayr famously dissected Darwin's work,
right,
concluding that on the origin of species wasn't a single idea, but a bundle of five related but separate theories spanning everything from common descent to gradualism. For the causal theory of evolutionary change to work, every single causal ingredient has to be present.
Wallace clearly identified the selective pressure, the environmental agent, as a core cause. So what essential pieces did he omit, which Darwin included?
The primary omissions in Wallace's 1858 essay are, well, they're the prerequisites for selection to even act. He failed to clearly address individual variation within a population.
Okay, so just the fact that there are differences.
Right. And perhaps more critically, he did not include the necessity that this variation must be, at least in part, heritable.
That's a huge distinction. Why isn't just saying there is variation enough? Why does it have to be heritable to be a necessary cause?
Well, think about it. If the traits that make an organism better suited to survive and reproduce, say, slightly longer legs helping a deer escape a predator, if those aren't passed down to its offspring, then evolution stops. It just grinds to a halt.
I see.
Selection works on the raw material of variation, but without inheritance, the advantageous trait just disappears with the individual. It becomes an interesting anecdote, not a law-like process of transformation across generations. Darwin understood that inheritance was a non-negotiable part of the causal set.
And Wallace's specific focus in the Turnip paper, which was titled On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart Indefinitely from the Original Type, that title actually reveals a conceptual flaw regarding variation that Darwin didn't share.
It really does. It highlights a major conceptual hurdle Wallace hadn't overcome. Wallace argued that modifications observed under domestication, like the massive differences between dog breeds or pigeon varieties, were not true evolutionary changes.
Why not?
Because he believed that if the domesticated form became feral, it would revert back to the original wild condition.
He believed true evolutionary change only moves in one direction, indefinitely away from the starting point.
Exactly. And this interpretation was incorrect. Darwin, conversely, he devoted the entire opening chapter of Origin to artificial selection. He used the staggering diversity of pigeon breeds, all stemming from the common rock dove, Columbolivia, as an essential, undeniable analog for natural selection.
So Darwin saw that these variations, even if artificially selected, showed the profound transformative power that was just latent inheritable variation.
Right. And by rejecting this analogy, Wallace fundamentally limited his understanding of the source and scope of variation, and that undercut his own causal theory.
This brings us to a highly nuanced point that our sources stress, the ambiguous terminology itself. The term natural selection apparently held two critically different meanings for evolutionists, starting with Darwin himself.
This is a sophisticated insight, and it's essential for understanding the theoretical gap. The term was used to refer to both the cause, so the selective agent, like environment, food competition, or predators, and the result, the overarching evolutionary change or outcome.
Okay, so if Darwin was inconsistent in his use, how do we distinguish between the two men?
Well, Darwin's major usage, especially in his later popularization of the theory, treated natural selection as the result, the overarching process that guaranteed change over time. It was the whole mechanism working together.
And Wallace.
Wallace's use of natural selection in his 1858 paper, however, was clearly and narrowly focused on the cause, the external demands placed by the environment. It was all about selective agents.
So if Wallace only identified the selective agent, which is a single nomological cause, but he omitted the other necessary causes, like heritable variation,
then his theory is incomplete. That is the argument.
I see.
If Wallace had meant natural selection, in the comprehensive way Darwin often used it, as the full result of multiple interactive processes, then he could arguably be credited with the full theory. But because his language, his rejection of domestication, and the lack of explicit inclusion of heritability all point toward him defining it narrowly as the selective agent,
he only gets partial credit.
He must be credited only as the discoverer of that crucial cause, but not the full, complete nomological theory of evolutionary change.
So the initial panic of Darwin, believing he had been forestalled, led him to misinterpret Wallace's essay as being identical to his own, which ultimately perpetuated this myth of co-discovery when the theoretical reality was far more asymmetrical.
Exactly right.
We have to turn now to the drama that fuels conspiracy theories to this day, the Turnot male controversy. If Darwin had received a complete theory, the question of when he received it becomes central to his integrity. This entire debate hinges on a missing original letter and manuscript from Wallace.
The exact chronology is, it's explosive.
Yeah.
We have two competing timelines. The accepted historical sequence, championed by researchers like John Van Wye, argues that Wallace mailed the essay on the April 1858 steamer, and Darwin received it on June 18, 1858.
And Darwin wrote to Lyell immediately that day, right? Saying he received it today.
Yes. That timeline is clean. It completely vindicates Darwin from any suggestion of deceit or revision. He acted immediately upon receipt.
But there's another theory.
There is. The Darwin conspiracy model, supported by researchers like Brooks and Davies, suggests Wallace mailed the essay much earlier, on the 9 March 1858 mail book.
And what's the evidence for this earlier date? It seems pretty specific.
The key piece of evidence is a letter Wallace sent to Frederick Bates, the brother of his naturalist colleague Henry Walter Bates, on the same steamer that supposedly carried the essay to Darwin. The Bates letter arrived in England on June 2nd, 1858.
Oh.
So if the mail was consistent, the essay should have arrived in early June, potentially June 2nd or 3rd.
And if the essay arrived on June 2nd or 3rd, and Darwin only wrote to Lyell on June 18th saying he received it today, that opens up a two-week window.
Exactly. This is the period during which conspiracy theorists claim Darwin could have revised his big book manuscript to incorporate Wallace's ideas without acknowledgement.
Is the accusation specific?
Very specific. Critics point to evidence that during this precise window, Darwin entered 66 new pages of material into his unpublished manuscript, all dealing with aspects of divergence. So if Wallace's manuscript contained novel insights on how varieties multiply and fill niches, those 66 pages could be interpreted as Darwin borrowing, digesting, and quickly assimilating those concepts.
That is a serious allegation. It suggests not just silent assimilation, but deliberate misstating of the receipt. But the timeline controversy also connects back to why Wallace sent the essay to Darwin in the first place.
Yes. Many arguments assume the Turnout letter must have been a reply to a previous Darwin letter, dated December 22, 1857. This hypothetical letter would have informed Wallace that Lyell had praised his earlier 1855 Sarawak essay, encouraging Wallace to trust Darwin as a conduit to Lyell.
And the main support for this reply assumption comes from a quote Wallace wrote much later in his 1905 autobiography, My Life.
Right. He recalled asking Darwin to show the paper to Lyell, who had thought so highly of my former paper.
But there's a problem with that memory.
This is where modern source criticism comes in. Researchers argue that this quote from a 1905 memoir is just insufficient proof. The specific remark about Lyell's past praise is absent from Wallace's earlier recollections of the discovery, like those published in 1903. This lack of confirmation suggests the reply interpretation might be a later memory conflation, or maybe even an embellishment.
So if the letter wasn't necessarily a reply, the earlier March 9th mailing date becomes more plausible even in a non-conspiracy context.
Precisely. The alternative sequence suggests Wallace sent the letter on March 9th before he received any incoming message from Darwin. Wallace simply knew Darwin was connected to the powerful Lyell and hoped he could use Darwin as a middleman to query Lyell about a totally different paper he was writing on the Aru Islands.
So if the March 9th timeline holds, the essay arrived in early June, and the two-week gap exists, whether Darwin intended deception or was simply too distressed to act immediately.
And this is the moment where we must pause and consider the immense personal tragedy that was unfolding in Darwin's life, regardless of whether he sat on the letter for 2 days or 2 weeks. The context of June 1858 is just agonizing.
It's heartbreaking. On June 18th, the very day Darwin claimed to receive Wallace's letter, his eldest daughter, Henrietta, was desperately ill with diphtheria. The tension and worry in the Darwin household must have been immense.
But the real tragedy struck just days later. His baby son, Charles Waring Darwin, only 18 months old, contracted scarlet fever, which was rampaging through their village.
And the disease moved so quickly and cruelly.
Charles Waring died unexpectedly on June 28, 1858, just 3 days before the crucial Linnean Society meeting. Darwin was shattered by grief. He couldn't possibly attend the meeting on July 1st. He and his wife, Emma, immediately fled to the Isle of Wight to escape the epidemic and mourn.
What stands out is how this profound personal turmoil frames the moment of scientific breakthrough. Emma, a woman of deep faith, attempted to offer spiritual comfort to her agonizing husband.
She urged him to believe that all suffering and illness is meant to help us to exalt our minds and to look forward with hope to a future state. The irony is just powerful.
Yeah.
At the very moment the greatest scientific explanation for natural mechanisms, one that excluded a divine designer, was being announced, Darwin was receiving deep spiritual solace from his wife while grappling with the brutal, non-selective reality of infant death.
The intense human drama of death and despair was the silent backdrop to the launch of their shared theory.
The pressure created by the joint presentation on July 1, 1858, had an immediate, profound impact on Darwin's professional life. He knew he could no longer afford the luxury of polishing his massive multi-volume big book Natural Selection.
Right. He felt compelled to publish a fuller statement quickly. He abandoned the exhaustive manuscript and decided to write an abstract instead.
But that abstract rapidly ballooned. It became what he called a small volume, written at an astonishing pace between June 1858 and March 1859. It was published in November 1859.
And the final iconic title was On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. It's interesting that the original draft titles included an essay on the origin of species and varieties.
Yeah, but he settled on a title that explicitly placed the mechanism of natural selection front and center.
One of the core theoretical components that Darwin included in great detail, which we argued was absent or underdeveloped in Wallace's initial essay, was the concept of divergence. Darwin himself called this the keystone of his longer work. What makes divergence so essential?
Divergence is the mechanism that explains the branching pattern of the tree of life. It moves beyond just mere lineal change, anagenesis. It explains why nature tends toward complexity and variety, not just gradual adaptation. Darwin observed that the same geographical spot supports more life if it's occupied by very diverse forms, not just numerous ones.
Can you provide an example to make that concept stick for us?
Sure. Think about a patch of land, say, a single square yard of turf. Darwin noted that within that tiny space, you find multiple generic forms. Different grasses, different flowering plants, mosses, insects. They're all competing, but their differences allow them to utilize resources. Light, water, nutrients in diverse, slightly specialized ways.
So if a species evolves into two distinct varieties, they aren't competing for the exact same resource set anymore. They each exploit a slightly different niche.
Exactly. This reduction in direct head-to-head competition for identical resources means that natural selection continually favors the divergence of character. The offspring of each species successfully seize on as many and as diverse places in the economy of nature as possible, leading to the branching and sub-branching of forms.
This is what generates the immense hierarchical structure of biological diversity we see.
And Wallace didn't develop this ecological and structural component of evolution in his 1858 essay. Darwin built his entire systematic view of nature around it.
Despite the tragedy and the rush, Origen became an instant phenomenon. What was the reaction outside of the close circle of Lyell and Hooker?
It caused instant intellectual turmoil and became a national bestseller. But Darwin received intense criticism from the scientific establishment. Adam Sedgwick, a highly respected geologist who had actually taught Darwin, condemned the book harshly.
What did he say?
He accused Darwin of abandoning the true method of induction and plunging into mere speculation.
And the famously quoted dismissal from Sir John Frederick William Herschel, the respected astronomer.
Oh, Herschel's dismissal was perhaps the most evocative. He labeled natural selection the law of higgledy-piggledy.
Higgledy-piggledy.
Suggesting it was just random chance, disorderly, and incapable of producing the intricate order we observe in life. This skepticism was common. Many people just could not fathom a blind, unconscious process achieving the sophistication of life.
Darwin's counter-strategy against this torrent of criticism was simple yet brilliant. He relied on the weight of accumulated evidence, essentially betting on explanatory power.
His proposition was so powerful. I cannot think a false theory would explain so many classes of facts as the theory seems to me to do. He basically challenged his critics to find a better single explanation that covered biogeography, embryology, homology, and the fossil record all at once.
And he did secure some crucial high-profile conversions, though not without a struggle.
He rejoiced in the conversion, or perversion, as he jokingly termed it, of powerful men. Thomas Henry Huxley, the anatomist, immediately became Darwin's most aggressive public defender.
Darwin's bulldog.
That's him. Lyell, however, struggled for over a decade. He was intellectually convinced of the mechanism for most species, but he could not bring himself to accept the implications for the origin of humankind.
He clung to a need for special creation for man's moral and intellectual faculties.
He did. Lyell understood the logic perfectly. He stated that if a vera causa, a true operational cause, was admitted for the rest of the animal kingdom, all consequences, including human descent, must follow. But emotionally and philosophically, he just resisted.
Lyell's hesitation shows that even among the closest allies, the implications of Origen were staggering.
Yet Darwin persisted, driven not by a desire for fame, but by a deeper personal conviction. He worked from a sort of instinct to try to make out truth.
If we trace the consequences of the 1858 split, we see that the theoretical difference, Wallace's utilitarian focus versus Darwin's more comprehensive vision, it didn't end with Origen. It ballooned into a profound philosophical divergence in later years, which still echoes in modern science.
This is where their worldviews completely fragmented. Wallace, after returning from his expeditions, became increasingly interested in spiritualism, and he eventually incorporated it into his evolutionary thought.
How so?
He argued that natural selection alone was insufficient to explain the highest human faculties.
He believed that the human mind, consciousness, morality, and our inherent aesthetic capacities, our appreciation for beauty, could not be explained by natural selection or the properties of matter.
No. He introduced a guiding spiritual force for those specific traits.
Darwin, conversely, doubled down on natural processes. He extended selection to humans in his 1871 work, The Descent of Man, and selection in relation to sex.
And this work was where he articulated the mechanism of sexual selection as a powerful evolutionary force, distinct from natural selection.
Darwin's view, the aesthetic view, argued that traits could evolve simply because they were attractive. They didn't have to confer survival advantage. They could evolve for purely non-functional reasons, an inherent taste for the beautiful.
This is the foundation for modern models like Fisherian runaway selection, named after R.A. Fisher. In this model, if females develop a slight preference for a trait, say, longer tail feathers, and that preference becomes genetically correlated with the trait itself, you get a positive feedback loop.
And the preference and the ornament accelerate, exaggerating the trait, like the peacock's plumage, far beyond any point of mere survival utility.
Exactly. Wallace, meanwhile, remained rigorously utilitarian. He flatly rejected the idea that non-human animals possess an aesthetic sense.
So for Wallace, any elaborate feature had to serve a function that contributes to survival or species recognition.
Right. Elaborate aesthetic features were, in his view, primarily products of natural selection for utility, like species identification or intimidating a predator. He dismissed sexual selection as largely irrelevant, believing it would be quickly overwhelmed by the demands of natural selection.
He was advocating the good genes model before it was even formally named. Attractive traits evolve because they honestly signal phenotypic quality, vigor, or vitality. You choose the beautiful mate because the beautiful mate is inherently better at surviving and passing on good genes.
That's it. And this utilitarian perspective, this insistence that everything biological must be an adaptation that solves a survival or reproductive problem, is what has dominated research for decades.
Our sources suggest that research in evolutionary psychology in particular has been overwhelmingly Wallacean. How does that adaptationist bias play out in current research?
Well, it establishes the default assumption that mental faculties, cognitive biases, and mate preferences must be direct adaptations.
Yeah.
When evolutionary psychologists study attractiveness, they usually assume symmetry, musculature, or other physical features are attractive because they honestly signal underlying quality developmental stability, immunocompetence, or fertility.
It's the direct link between beauty and utility.
Always.
But if this approach is so pervasive, where are the cracks appearing?
The problem lies in the empirical evidence for the purely Wallacean good genes model. Studies attempting to link attractiveness, like facial symmetry.
Right, often measured via fluctuating asymmetry or those minor random deviations from perfect bilateral symmetry.
Exactly. So studies linking that directly to underlying immunocompetence or reproductive fitness often show results that are highly equivocal, small in effect size, or just inconsistent across populations.
And there's also the problem of publication bias, isn't there?
Absolutely. Researchers have a strong incentive to publish positive findings showing that a feature is a sign of good genes rather than publishing null findings where no such correlation exists. And this bias artificially inflates the perceived strength of the good genes or utilitarian models. It suggests that the adaptationist approach alone is deeply insufficient to explain the evolution of mate choice.
And this is the historical moment that allows Darwin's original marginalized aesthetic view to re-enter the scientific mainstream. Let's talk about the modern effort to revive it, the Land-Kirkpatrick, or LK, null model of sexual selection.
The LK model, championed prominently by ornithologist Richard Prum, is a direct challenge to the entrenched utilitarianism. It mathematically models the coevolution of a male trait and a female preference, and it aligns perfectly with Darwin's aesthetic concept.
Why is it called the null model?
Because it forces researchers to strip away the assumptions of utility. The model demonstrates that trait preference genetic correlations can manifest and drive evolutionary change without the influence of natural selection acting on the mate preferences themselves.
So it suggests that preference can arise through stochastic processes like genetic drift or simply through arbitrary starting points.
Yes. It provides a rigorous scientific framework for the idea that beauty can evolve simply for beauty's sake. Prum's famous beauty happens hypothesis.
That's a great phrase.
The LK model tells researchers, before you assume this elaborate peacock tail is a costly, honest signal of health, Wallacean view, you must first assume that the tail became elaborate merely because the female started to prefer it, perhaps by chance or through genetic drift, and that preference was arbitrary.
You have to test against the null hypothesis that traits became attractive incidentally, rather than automatically assuming they are adaptations signaling underlying quality.
That's the paradigm shift. It means the philosophical split established between Darwin and Wallace utility versus arbitrary aesthetic appeal is still defining the core methodology of evolutionary mate choice research today. The 1859 argument is being mathematically modeled and tested in labs right now.
It's a powerful illustration of how deep theoretical foundations matter. Darwin's comprehensive vision allowed for both utility and arbitrary aesthetics, whereas Wallace's narrower utilitarian view inadvertently constrained evolutionary thought for over a century, particularly in human psychology.
Yes, exactly.
We have certainly taken the deep dive today. We started with the standard story of co-discovery between Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, acknowledging the historical necessity of the joint 1858 paper designed to secure priority for Darwin's work, matured by years of reflection.
And we uncovered that the famous joint paper actually contained a partial discovery by Wallace. We detailed the theoretical difference, showing how Wallace provided a brilliant but incomplete nomological theory of selective agents, while Darwin's full theory encompassed the necessary components of heritable variation and the essential ecological engine of divergence.
And we didn't shy away from the high drama of the priority debate, the Turnitin-Male controversy, where two compelling, unresolvable timelines exist, either vindicating Darwin's integrity or raising questions about delayed action, all set against the agonizing backdrop of the unexpected death of his infant son.
Finally, we trace their fundamental philosophical divergence, Wallace's utilitarian adaptationism versus Darwin's aesthetic view, and showed how this split defines modern scientific debates. Wallace's viewpoint dominates much of adaptationist evolutionary psychology.
While Darwin's aesthetic insight is finding rigorous mathematical grounding today in the Land-Kirkpatrick-Null model, forcing researchers to consider that arbitrary beauty might drive evolution just as powerfully as utility.
The joint paper was intended to resolve priority, but it ultimately revealed a deep, unbridgeable philosophical chasm. The biggest difference between the two men was not simply a matter of scientific timing or who saw a specific phenomenon first, but a disagreement over the limits of materialism, the role of mind, non-utilitarian beauty, and spiritual forces in nature.
And that conceptual battle continues to define the cutting edge of research, which leaves us with this to consider. If Wallace had received Darwin's detailed 1844 manuscript sketch first, would the modern scientific world still be arguing so fiercely over whose ideas, the beautiful or the utilitarian, are more complete?